Today at Reader's Corner, Candace Millard, author of Destiny of the Republic, a tale of madness, medicine, and the murder of a president. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. A shot fired in the lobby of a Washington, D.C. train station in 1881 would eventually claim the life of the United States' 20th president, James A. Garfield. According to today's guest, author Candace Millard, the assassination also shook the very core of the nation. In her book, Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President, Ms. Millard interweaves the story of a little-known president with that of his delusional assassin to paint a clear picture of an America fractured by civil war and weakened by political corruption. Today we're featuring an encore of our interview with Ms. Millard. She is a former writer and editor for National Geographic and the author of a previous book, The River of Doubt, about Theodore Roosevelt's scientific exploration of the Amazon rainforest in 1913 and 1914. Destiny of the Republic, now out in paperback, won the Edgar Award, the Penn Center USA Award, and was named a Best Book of the Year by the New York Times, the Washington Post, Amazon, and several others. Ms. Millard joins us by phone from Kansas City, Missouri, for this interview. Candace Millard, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me.
Candace, I can't tell you how many times in my old job of teaching American government I raced through the 19th century, stopped at Garfield's assassination, identified a disgruntled job seeker as the guy who killed him, and moved on and didn't stop to think too much more about this man, James A. Garfield. And thanks to you and your book, you have just done us all a great service by really explaining the life of a man who was exemplary. I mean, it's an incredible life. Could you give us just a few key aspects of his life, which really does put him right alongside the log cabin Lincoln?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of similarities with Lincoln. As you know, Garfield was actually our last president to be born in a log cabin. He was extremely, extremely poor. In fact, he didn't have shoes until he was 4 years old, growing up in Ohio, if you can imagine. But he was absolutely brilliant from a very young age. He put himself through college working as a carpenter and a janitor. But by his sophomore year of college, he became a professor of mathematics, literature, and ancient languages. By the time he was 26, he was a university president. He was an incredible classicist. He knew the entire Aeneid by heart in Latin. And while he was in Congress, if you can imagine this, while he was in Congress, he wrote an original proof of the Pythagorean theorem. So he was really off the charts brilliant, really one of the most extraordinary men ever elected president. But to me, what is more interesting and more inspirational about Garfield was his decency. He had a heart to match his mind. He was a Civil War hero. He hid a runaway slave. He was instrumental in bringing about black suffrage. He was a devoted father and husband and just a good, kind, honest man.
Being an avowed abolitionist in that particular time of our history, that's saying something in itself that he could get past a convention. Of course, the Republicans at that time were those who were trying to build on the success of the Civil War. Could you help us explain how that happened? Because this is not a guy, in those days, first of all, there were no primaries. So these conventions were just groups of party bosses that got together and nominated. And here he shows up at the convention for somebody else.
That's right. So the convention, the Republican convention in the summer of 1880 was in Chicago. It was in this enormous hall. There were 15,000 people there. And the favorite to win the nomination by far was Ulysses S. Grant, who was hoping for a third term in the White House. And Garfield had gone there not as a candidate, not even wanting to be a candidate. He had gone to give the nominating address for another man. And he gets up to speak, to give this address, and the hall is just incredibly rowdy. Everyone's shouting for Grant. And he begins to speak, and the hall slowly quiets, and he gives this extraordinary speech. It was so powerful and eloquent, and it's extemporaneous that everyone is just spellbound. They're just riveted. And at one point he says, "And so, gentlemen, I ask you, what do we want? And someone in the hall shouts, we want Garfield. And everybody just goes crazy. And when the balloting begins, people begin casting their ballots for Garfield, even though, again, he wasn't even a candidate, if you can imagine that in today's terms. And what begins as sort of this trickle of votes becomes a river, becomes a stream, and there's finally a flood of votes for Garfield, and he finds himself the Republican nominee for president of the United States. It's just an extraordinary scene.
So he's the Republican nominee. Does he really campaign for the presidency the way we campaign for presidencies today?
Not at all. He was advised not to. You know, Lincoln never campaigned for either of his terms, and Garfield, too, was advised to sit cross-legged and look wise. And so he stayed. He had this farmhouse in Ohio, in Mentor, Ohio, which is now this beautiful National Historic Site. And he stayed there, and people came to him. In fact, the journalists nicknamed it Lawn Field because there's this sort of wide, sweeping lawn in front of it where everyone, all these journalists would gather, and groups of people would come to him, and he had what they called front porch talks. In fact, he gave the first presidential campaign speech in another language in America, which he spoke in German to a group of German immigrants. And always incredibly moving, and these groups of freed slaves would come, and he would say, you know, I stand with you, and I will fight for you, and just incredibly moving and powerful speeches.
So he's elected president of the United States. What's his reaction?
He's stunned, and strangely, he's sort of saddened. He says he feels a sorrow in this triumph that he can't quite explain, and he thinks of the presidency as a bleak mountain. You know, he knows it's going to be lonely, and it's going to be very difficult, and it's going to completely change his life. You know, he had been in Congress for nearly 18 years, but he had taken every opportunity, every summer, and every opportunity to go back to Ohio. He had 5 children he adored and spent as much time with them as he could, and he knew that his life was going to change completely, mostly because of the spoils system. And he gets into office, and sure enough, you know, he's expected to spend from 10:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. every day meeting with office seekers one-on-one. It's just, we can't imagine it today.
Well, you know, that quote that you mentioned, that he referred to the presidency as a bleak mountain he was obliged to ascend. I read that and I thought, can you imagine an American president today so discouraged and depressed about assuming the presidency?
That's right. But, you know, I mean, as much as Garfield understood the realities of what he was about to take on, he also took the presidency very seriously and had things that he cared about that he wanted to do for the country. You know, he cared very much about rights for freed slaves, cared very, very much about education and civil service reform. So he was determined to do what he could, but he despaired at the time and thought taken away by these office seekers.
And again, in those days, and even today for that matter, we refer to that as the spoils system, the system whereby jobs were given out based on influence, based on friendship, on party affiliation. Well, there's still some of that that goes on today, you could argue, but nothing, I guess, like it was in those days.
That's right. No, it was blatant and rampant and just, you know, it was the machine politics, and no one was apologizing for it, and everyone wanted a piece of it. And today we think of, absolutely, there's cronyism and there's, you know, a lot of corruption that just happens within Washington, but this extended throughout the country. I mean, many Americans believed that they were entitled to government positions, whether they had any experience for them or not, and they believed that they were entitled to make their case directly to the president himself, and he had no Secret Service protection, even though, you know, this is 16 years after Lincoln's assassination, and here is the president meeting in his office in the White House with anybody who wants to come ask for a job.
You're listening to Candace Millard. She's the author of Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. You don't happen to know when Secret Service protection started. Did this cause it to start, or did it start later?
Astonishingly, it didn't. The president didn't receive Secret Service protection until the assassination of McKinley 20 years later, our third presidential assassination. Well, with Lincoln's, it was believed that this was just an act of war. This would never happen again, even though, you know, there are a lot of assassinations taking place in Europe. But Americans believed, you know, that's because they have monarchies. Here we get to freely choose our president, so there shouldn't be any danger. And this is a time of peace. So Garfield's assassination was not only incredibly sorrowful, but also shocking. But with him, they believed that it was because of the spoil system, because of the man who had killed him, who had been seeking office, and they believed that's why he shot Garfield. And so it took another 20 years and another presidential assassination until we finally figured out that we need to protect our presidents.
Charles Guiteau, let's talk about that assassin. First of all, it appears to us all from reading your book that this was not a man who was mentally stable. He had very serious mental issues to deal with, and obviously they were not treated. And then apparently even came from a family of people who were less than mentally stable.
Right. So Charles Guiteau was a deeply, dangerously delusional man. He was very intelligent. He was very articulate. But he was insane and had been for a long time from a young age. And as you say, there had been some history of it in his family, certainly. And his sister, who his mother had died when he was young, and his sister had sort of raised him, had actually tried to have him institutionalized at several points. But this was, you know, a very different time in our country's history. It's a time when nobody really understood what he was up to and could hold him to account for it. You know, he would just slip away again and again. He lived this very isolated, very peripatetic life. He would just move from city to city, job to job, boarding house to boarding house. And if there were problems, he would just disappear and reappear somewhere else. And so it was really hard to get him the help that he needed. But he certainly shouldn't have been in any position to be a danger to anyone, much less the President of the United States.
You know, in today's world, you can say that, well, somebody should have been there to give him the help that he needed. I guess I have to ask, in the middle of the second half of the 19th century, what was there formalized help? Was it easy to find help in those days?
Yeah, there were psychiatrists, psychologists, there were institutions to take care of people. I mean, by today's standards, I don't know if we would consider them the best places to be, but there was help available. His sister, what she tried to do is to have him formally institutionalized involuntarily, and by that you have to go through a trial and all kinds of things, and so it was a long process that, again, he wouldn't stick around for. But there was help available. He just wasn't willing to seek it. And he, you know, his particular brand of madness, because he was delusional, he certainly didn't think he needed help. He thought that he was destined for greatness, and that's why he was a failed lawyer, he was a failed evangelist. He even tried a free love commune, if you can imagine, in the 1800s, and he failed even there. The women in the commune nicknamed him Charles Get Out. So he just had these series of failures throughout his life, but he continued to believe that he was an extraordinary human being who was destined for something great.
And more specifically, he thought the president and the secretary of state had him in line for a particular position.
Right. So, you know, everyone was abuzz about Garfield's surprise nomination, and Guiteau would read every single newspaper he could get his hands on, and so he knew about this, and he knew all about the spoil system and thought it was a great thing. And so what he thought, all he had to do was get in line first. And so immediately after Garfield's nomination, he went to New York and went to the campaign office and went there every day. He had written this speech, and he wanted to give the speech, and finally they give him a chance, and he sort of gives half of it and runs off the stage, and that's it. But then when Garfield is nominated, he thinks, you know, in his mind, he believes that he made Garfield president, so he deserves some, not just some job, but a great post. And so he decides that he should be made ambassador to France. I mean, it's just, you know, crazy, but he believes this, and so he thinks, you know, I'll write to the president and request this, and since I'll be first in line, I'll get it. And he writes letters, and then he moves to Washington, and he goes to the White House every day. He goes to the State Department every day demanding this post, and then he says, well, okay, if you know, I'll take the ambassadorship to Austria, but I'd rather be in Paris. But he goes back and forth and just does not give up, all the time growing more and more desperate. He has no form of support. He's starving. His clothes are in rags, and he's growing more and more delusional.
Now, tell us how and where the assassination actually came off.
So finally, Guiteau has what he believes is a divine inspiration, that God wants him to kill the president. And so he begins to stalk Garfield with this in mind. He follows him to church, considers shooting him at his church. He follows him to a train station with the First Lady, but she had been ill, and he sort of thinks, oh, that'd be cruel to kill her husband in front of her. So finally, you know, at that time, you could also, you knew, if you read the papers, you knew exactly where the president was at all times, and Garfield's planning a trip east, and Guiteau knows that he's going to be at the Baltimore and Potomac train station the morning of July 2nd, 1881. And the train station was on the National Mall. It's actually where the National Art Museum stands today, the Smithsonian. And so he went there, and he was waiting for Garfield when Garfield arrived. And moments after Garfield stepped into the train station, Guiteau steps out of the shadows and shoots him twice. Once in the arm and once in the back.
Before we get into the story of what happens next as far as the doctor's role in actually killing Garfield, or at least making sure he wasn't going to live, I want to at least mention the issue of the gunshot wound itself. Help us understand how fatal this gunshot wound in and of itself was or was not.
Tragically, the gunshot wound was not fatal at all. It tore through his back, but it didn't hit any vital organs. It didn't hit his spinal cord. It went through the column, but didn't hit the spinal cord. And it went behind his pancreas. So it went in the right, went over to the left. And it would end up existing there and do no more damage. You know, this is not long after the Civil War, so there were a lot of men walking around with bullets in them. In fact, the detective who would take Guiteau to jail after he shot Garfield had a bullet in his brain from the Civil War, had been there, you know, more than a decade, and was doing just fine. Unfortunately, for Garfield and for the nation, one doctor in particular stepped forward, and immediately infection was introduced.
And that was Dr. Willard Bliss?
Right, Dr. Willard Bliss, whose first name was Doctor. Yeah, his parents had named him Doctor, kind of sort of determined that he would be a doctor. Right, so when Garfield shot at the train station, the first doctor to arrive immediately inserts unsterilized fingers and instruments in this wound in his back on the train station floor, if you can imagine a more germ-infested environment. And then they get this old horsehair mattress and put him on it and carry him to a room upstairs. And eight other doctors come to the train station, all wanting to examine the president. Now, Robert Todd Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln's son, was Garfield's Secretary of War and also happened to be at the train station that day, and remembered one doctor in particular, Dr. Bliss, who had been at his father's deathbed. And he sends his carriage for Dr. Bliss. And Dr. Bliss comes in and immediately takes over and himself examines Garfield, probing the wound again, unsterilized fingers and instruments. And all these doctors go back to the White House with Garfield, and Bliss takes over, dismissing all the other doctors and taking charge himself of Garfield's medical care.
And what we learn in your book is that if President Garfield would have lived, it would have been because he might have been treated by a doctor who wasn't on the scene, and that would have been Dr. Joseph Lister. Tell us the role that he was playing in medicine at the time and why it would have been far better to have Lister at the president's side than these 10 doctors who didn't get it.
So Joseph Lister was a renowned British surgeon, and he had discovered antisepsis 16 years earlier. So it's not a little theory, a new little theory from an unknown surgeon. He was very, very well known. He had had dramatic results in his own surgical ward. He had traveled around the world telling doctors to sterilize their hands and instruments and warning them that if they didn't, they ran the very real risk of killing their patients. And he was invited to our centennial exposition in 1876, so not long before this, as to be the keynote speaker of the medical congress there. In fact, one of Garfield's surgeons, one of the surgeons who would work on Garfield, went to this exposition, and Lister was begging the doctors in the United States to listen to him, to understand germ theory, and to practice antisepsis. But, you know, they still dismissed it as useless, even dangerous, and they just didn't want to go to all the trouble that it required to kill germs. In fact, you know, if you can imagine, surgeons at that time refused to change or wash their surgical aprons because they thought the more blood and pus encrusted on them, the more experience it showed. And even those who tried antisepsis often failed because they would sterilize their surgical knives before surgery, but if they dropped them during surgery, they would just pick them up and continue to use them. Or if they needed their both hands during surgery, they would hold the knife in their teeth and then continue to use them. So Lister had an uphill battle in the United States with, ironically, the most respected and experienced doctors and convincing them to use antisepsis.
You're listening to Candace Millard. She is the author of Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. What did they do? Washed their hands in carbolic acid, did I hear?
Carbolic acid. They would spray it. They would spray the wound, spray the air around it. Uh-huh. Yeah, clean everything in carbolic acid. And, you know, as the years went by, they found better ways to do it because there were problems with carbolic acid. But it did the job. It killed germs, and it saved countless lives, you know. And immediately after Garfield's death, after the autopsy results are released, the American people understand that their president didn't have to die, and they understand why he did. Bliss is publicly disgraced, and antisepsis is accepted and adopted around the country.
You're listening to Candace Millard. She's the author of Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. Well, you know, I never really picked that up. So the doctor, the lead doctor at least, if not some of the others, by the time their lives and careers were over, did in fact face the music. They were, you use the word, disgraced publicly?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Dr. Bliss, there were many, 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 many articles right after Garfield's death. Just excoriating Dr. Bliss in medical journals. I think that the lesson from this tragedy is the danger of arrogance, you know, not just ignorance. This was willful ignorance. You know, it's one thing if, you know, it's sort of that's not known at that time, or maybe it's a new theory that's not known. This was this case of somebody thinking he knew much better and being very aware that the eyes of the nation and even the world were on him and where of his own sort of potential for fame and power. And he was just an incredibly arrogant man and wasn't going to listen to anyone and thought, I've always practiced this way and I'm going to continue to practice this way. And it, you know, it led to a tremendous tragedy.
Well, he lingered for 2 months. What were those weeks like, both for him and for the nation? And I call particular attention to something I think you said toward the end of the book about how the North and the South trusted this guy, this president, and it was Garfield that was going to heal the wounds of the Civil War, and then this happens. 2 months is a long time. What's going on in the nation during this time?
So Garfield was unique. You know, this was, again, shocking because it was a presidential assassination, and horrifying because of the suffering going on, but it was particularly terrible because it was Garfield, because Garfield was the first president since the Civil War to be accepted as a leader of the whole country, North and South, immigrant and pioneer, freed slave and former slave owner, you know, because he had obviously made it very clear where he stood on abolition, but he had also extended a hand to the South and wasn't looking for vengeance. He wanted healing, and he thought the answer was education. You know, education had been his salvation, and he believed strongly that it would be the salvation of the South. And so that's what he was working toward. And you know, it's interesting because while Lincoln's assassination had only deepened the divide between the North and the South, Garfield's, the shooting of Garfield and his death did bring the country together, not perfectly and not permanently. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of suffering to go on moving forward, but it was, they joined in sorrow. You know, this was their common grief, and the South said, you know, we weren't allowed to mourn for Lincoln, but this is our president too, and we are mourning his loss as well, and that was very unifying for this country.
I love the way a character in history finds his way into a story. So here's Alexander Graham Bell contributes to this effort to try to save the president. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, this is actually how I came to this story. I was just doing general research, and I was reading about Alexander Graham Bell, and I stumbled upon the story of him inventing something called an induction balance, which was basically a metal detector connected to a telephone receiver to try to find the bullet in Garfield. This is 14 years before the invention of the medical X-ray. And I was stunned. You know, I'd never heard this story before, and I wondered why Bell would do this. Bell was only 34 years old at this time. So he had invented the telephone just 5 years earlier when he was only 29. And so he had set up this little laboratory in D.C., and he was there when Garfield was shot in this train station in D.C. And he immediately dropped everything he was doing, turned his life upside down to try to help Garfield. For months, making this invention, you know, there's nothing like it. The world is watching, and he is racing to try to figure out where this bullet is and stop the probing of these doctors trying to save the life of this president.
So Jester Arthur was James Garfield's vice president. Neither one of them really had much of a chance to do anything in those respective offices because, of course, Garfield was shot 4 months after assuming the office. Chester Arthur, I don't think many people thought Chester Arthur was going to be a good vice president. He wasn't well thought of, or at least that's the way it seemed to come off in your book. So how does it work out for the nation? How does Chester Arthur do in his ascension to the presidency after Garfield's assassination?
Chester Arthur's story is actually one of my favorites to come out of this book. I had no idea. I remember my editor saying, I never believed there'd be anything interesting to say about Chester Arthur. Chester Arthur was Garfield's vice president, but he was Roscoe Conkling's man. Senator Roscoe Conkling had appointed himself Garfield's enemy and was really the baron of patronage and the spoil system. And Chester Arthur was his man. And so Chester Arthur had taken every opportunity to publicly criticize Garfield and make it clear where his loyalties lay. And you know, Chester Arthur, the only other political office he had held before becoming vice president was as the controller of the New York Customs House, a position that Conkling had given to him. He made as much money as the president in that role, and he never showed up for work before noon. You know, he liked fine clothes and good wine and dinner parties and things like that. He wasn't a man of substance. So when Garfield was shot, the country was horrified that Chester Arthur might become president. But amazingly, Arthur was not waiting in the wings. Arthur was grief-stricken and stunned by the shooting, and the last thing he wanted was for Garfield to die. And when Garfield does, Arthur cuts himself off from Conkling and that whole crowd that had opposed Garfield, and he tries to become the kind of president that Garfield would have been had he lived. And amazingly to me, Arthur finds moral strength in really the most unlikely of places. The letters of an invalid young woman named Julia Sand, who begins writing to him, urging him to rise to the occasion. You know, she says, I'm writing to you not to beg you to resign, but to do what is more difficult and more brave, reform. And to everyone's astonishment, not least of all his own, Arthur does. And he becomes obviously not a great president, but at least a respected one and an honest one. And that's far more than anyone had expected.
Well, it's nice to know there's a little bit of a silver lining to that story anyway. Candace, we've run out of time, but I really want to thank you for this book. It's a great read, as I was telling you before the show. I recommended it to a friend just the other day. It's written as a suspense, and of course you've already won an Edgar Award, which shows you know how to do that. We thank you very much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. That's Candace Millard, author of Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Candace Millard. Next week, NPR's Fresh Air book critic Maureen Corrigan, author of So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. You can find previous shows, including a recent interview with National Book Award winner Timothy Egan, on our website. That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org.